schools and provided entertainment and gospel music for people all over that part of the world. He was a man who believed in God, not what most people would call a religious man, certainly not a church-going man, and been out of church for a long time. And whenever I was waiting, you know, before the funeral, we would have visitation at the funeral home, and I would sit there, and people would come in and visit. And they would sit down and tell me things about my dad, many of which I did not know and had never heard. Because we had, in the nature of our life, of our jobs, my career, had spent enormous amounts of time away from home since I was 18 years old. I joined the Navy and then went on to other things. And so consequently, in the later years, I had not really spent as much time with my dad as I would have liked to have done. So I learned a lot about him from other people at that time. And as I waited in the funeral home, a young boy came in whom I had never seen before and did not know. And he went over and stared a long time at my father as he lay there in his coffin. And we exchanged a few words, and he left. And I was told later, not much later, by my sister, that young man lived down the street from my dad. The boy did not have a father. Mother was on her own. And my father had sort of taken him under his wing and taken him fishing on a number of occasions. So the boy was there to do for him what I was not. To be with him, to go with him, and to share with him. When I conducted his funeral, I mentioned that, and how that he was not a church-going man, but nevertheless, I would feel much better in many ways standing before God in the resurrection in his shoes than in the shoes of many religious people that I have known in my life. I can tell you that at the end, I was very proud of my father. I was proud that he was my father. I was honored to be his son, and he was proud of me. Even if I had no scripture at all to tell me this, I would know, because I had a father that I know this about, that it is necessary for a man to confess his father. And so if God is your father, it is necessary that we confess him. It's also necessary for us to confess God. And once is not nearly enough. In my earliest church experience, as a very young man, I walked down the aisle in response to a preacher's call. The invitational hymn was something like Just As I Am, or one of those old invitational hymns. And I walked down as the custom was and shook hands with the preacher, and he asked me some questions quietly in my ear there in the front of the whole church. And I told him that yes to the questions. It was about accepting Christ as my personal Savior and so forth. And a little later, I went through in the little baptistry up at the front of this church, the public rite of baptism before the whole church. And in the process, I made what was basically called in that church a public confession of faith, or profession of faith. And it was something that all of us did. But the one thing that was wrong with that was that it was, in a sense, family. It's one thing when you are attending a church as a young man, and all the people in the church know you, all of them like you, all of them are hoping for the moment when you will actually do what you are just now doing, and are very pleased that you have done so. It is one thing to confess your Father and to confess Christ in front of those people. It is one thing to go up in a little baptistry. It's a little scary when you're young and you haven't done this sort of thing before. It's a little bit, your knees kind of shake a little bit. It's one thing to be plunged under the waters of baptism and come up out of them and to confess Jesus Christ as your personal Savior in front of people who like you, are proud of you, are pleased with you, and take great joy in what you are now doing. Unfortunately, for me, at the time, that was basically the end of confessing Christ, or of confessing my Father, of my profession of faith. For in that tradition, that profession of faith was the saving moment. And once you were saved, you were always saved. And the convenient thing for me, I guess I should take great encouragement in it, is those people, even to this day, no matter what I have done, no matter where I am, still believe that I am saved. So they would not be worrying about me being here speaking to a bunch of Sabbath keepers today. For they believe that since I was saved then, I can never once again be unsaved. I also come to believe that that confession in private is not enough, that the confession must be made public. I also came to realize, and I would have realized this if, again, without a single scripture to tell me that this was so, that the confession of the mouth is not enough. That you can say Jesus is Lord, and I never, will never forget in my lifetime the little shop up in Tyler where we used to go to lunch all the time, which made submarine sandwiches. The bread was fresh. He baked it himself. The meat was the best he could possibly find. Wonderful sandwiches. And we used to be just regular as clockwork to that little sandwich shop. He sold out one day to a guy. He took his money and moved off to Florida to retire and to have a good life because he'd made a lot of money with his sandwich shop and got a lot of money for it when it sold. The new owner came in, put a sign on the wall that said, Jesus is Lord, and immediately cut the value and the quality of all of his merchandise. The business went down, it declined, and finally it failed, and the man lost all the money he invested in it, having said, Jesus is Lord, but then having begun, frankly, to cheat his customers by charging the same price the other guy did for very poor merchandise. The confession with the mouth is not enough. Somehow, your confession of God must appear. It must appear outside of family. It must appear outside of church. It must affect your life. It must cost you something. For a confession that costs you nothing is not worth anything. Man must come to the place to where he confesses his God, his Father. My first real moment of confession came in 1958 when I was in Hardin Simmons University in Abilene, Texas, studying to be a Baptist preacher. And my brother-in-law kept coming up to visit me, and we kept talking about scriptures until 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning because he had been a Baptist and he was now a member of something called the Radio Church of God. And I was determined to convert him back to being a Baptist again, because I thought the poor guy had gone astray. And so we studied, and we studied, and we studied. In the course of our studies together, I came to the absolute conviction of the Sabbath day. Well, I was in college at Hardin Simmons, but I had a summer job. I worked at a little branch post office in a drugstore in a street not far from our apartment. And I found out very shortly after I believed I had to keep the Sabbath day that they wanted me to work on the Sabbath day. And so I faced, in such a small way, such a tiny thing, with so little at stake, I faced the first real confession of my faith in Jesus Christ, in the Father, that I had learned, taught me about the Sabbath day. Now, I know that this story is familiar to all of you. My first experience with it was so small. I think if we were to begin to take testimonials out of this audience, we could be here next week listening to the stories. Some of them, I mean, most of them, much greater than mine. For mine was not way down deep into an important career. Mine was a part-time postal clerk who probably could have, in fact, did wind up going and getting another part-time job later on to try to work my way around the problems that I faced. So we all had to face these things again and again. We have long called the fourth commandment the test commandment, haven't we? We do that because it was the one that God gave to Israel. And he said, I want to do this to see whether you will keep my laws or not. In Exodus, the 16th chapter, comes the whole great incident of manna being poured down from heaven. He says, I got to test you. I have to prove you to see whether we're going to even go beyond this point or not. For if you cannot manage this small test, what will you do? And what kind of confession might I ever expect for you? So it was a test commandment for Israel. It was a test commandment for me. And I know for a fact that it was a test commandment for most of you people in this room. It may very well have been your first profession of faith. The fourth commandment I found to be a sweet little piece of logic and parallel structure. I had to really respond well to what Dr. Sam said this morning about people who think. Because we can throw proof text back and forth like hand grenades, which I see a lot of nowadays. But it seems rather rare to find people who are willing to sit down and think about what it is that they are looking at. And so you can proof text to your heart's content, but when you go back and you read the fourth commandment, you have to ask yourself, what on earth could be more simple than the fourth commandment? For it tells you what to do, it tells you how to do it, And then it tells you why anyone should be able to understand it. What you are to do is to remember the Sabbath day, to set it apart. How do you do this? Well, you do it by working 6 days and then not working on the seventh. Why do you do it? Oh, well, this is really simple. Because God worked 6 days, and God rested the seventh, and then God blessed the seventh day and set it apart. The fourth commandment, in a nutshell. And the parallel structure in it is as simple as it can be. You remember the seventh day, and you set it apart, because God rested the seventh day and set it apart. I have been listening to reading arguments on this back and forth in some of the computer forums recently, and rather enjoying the experience of hearing and seeing lots and lots of new ideas and all this thing. And I have been fascinated by, as I said, I started calling it theology as contact sport, because it is people who are throwing ideas back and forth. I say ideas. They're throwing texts back. You know, there are a lot of people. You ask him a question. You sit on your keyboard and you ask this well-thought-out question. And his reply comes back, read Galatians 5:22. Well, I feel like saying, well, you know, I have read Galatians 5:22. I taught the book of Galatians 6 years in a row, 7 years in a row in Brickett Wood. I've studied it back to front. I have a whole series of tapes. I have, in fact, 3 series of tapes on the book of Galatians. What is it about Galatians 5:22 that you want me to, think about? What is it you want me to know about it? What is it you think that in all my previous readings of the book of Galatians that I have managed to miss buried down in this text that is here? But I've also been fascinated by two other odd little arguments that keep going on, and wondering why it is that people don't seem to think beyond these. For example, a great deal is being made in some of the debate going back and forth about the question of whether or not the Sabbath is holy time. Many of you old-timers will remember Herbert Armstrong's favorite thing about having the pan of cold water, icy cold water, and you hand the cold water to somebody and say, here, keep this hot. The guy blinks and says, what do you mean, keep it hot? I'd have to make it hot before I can keep it hot. And so a great argument is built up over this word, keep it hot, relative to the fact, well, God made the Sabbath holy. All we can do is keep it holy. We can't make it holy. The funny thing about it is, if you actually look at those texts and do your little best little computer research on them you can, you find the word keep isn't even present in the passage. And you find, in fact, that the word holy as an adjective is not present in the passage. It's a verb. And the verb means to set apart. It's like you had 6 of those little candies that you have, and seven of them. You just lay the 7 of them out on your tabletop, or you have 6, 7 of them in the bowl, and they are all there together. And you take one of them, and you set it apart. That's the whole deal of making something holy, in the sense of the words that we're talking about. Now, by derivation and by the way in which those words are used in the Bible, we come to understand that means you set it apart for God. Or you may set money apart for God. You may set time apart for God. You may make a commitment that you're going to spend certain time each day over the next week in prayer, and you put that time apart for God. And the big argument's going on about whether or not a man can make time holy. Well, in fact, the commandment simply says, you remember the Sabbath day to set it apart. And you do so because God rested on the Sabbath day and set it apart. How simple does something have to be? And then there is this incredibly simple little question that follows. When did he do that? Does everybody know? At creation. And I'm reading people's postings on there and seeing people trying to explain at great length. The Sabbath did not exist before Moses. And I think to myself, I feel the same emotion that Sam was expressing this morning. When are people going to think? When are they going to use their minds? When are they going to consider, you know, that God not only set the day apart, he blessed it, and Genesis tells us he did it the day after he finished work. Well, when you look at these things and you try to understand it, there's another little argument that's going around that I find a little troubling. It is staggering the degree to which people have focused in on the question of what is the day of worship. Now, I've read a lot of things that talk about how that the Sabbath, or I think I've seen a lot of the expression, Christ is our Sabbath. I've seen in numerous places, and I still have not figured out what that means. I have seen, conversations about whether or not we're going to worship on the Sabbath, or that Sunday should be the day to worship, or that Sunday could be the day to worship. And I go back to the fourth commandment, and I say, wait. Where is the word worship or worship service in the fourth commandment? There's nothing in there. The fourth commandment is something you can keep entirely alone. And in fact, as Dr. Sam said, that's what his family did first, because they had no alternative. Who'd the Ethiopian eunuch assemble with when he went back to Ethiopia? Himself. That's all. And so that is what the man had to do. He had no choice. Now, I asked you earlier, I said, when did God do that? Well, he did it when he finished his work. In the first chapter of Genesis, right at the very beginning, are some of the most familiar words in the English language. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness brooded over the face of the deep. And then God said, let there be light. And in that little phrase is such an incredible power. I did not know, I did not even begin to grasp the significance of what that meant, I don't think, until I read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. And I realized that what the time that he called the singularity, that if you look out at the stars at night and you walk out like David and said, when I consider the moon and the stars and all the things that your hand have made, I say, what is man that you are mindful of him? And I think to myself, how little he knew. How little he knew. He didn't know that the light that was falling on his eyes had been traveling toward him, something in the neighborhood of, what shall we say, depending on the star, conceivably 3 billion years, or another star, 8 billion years, or a galaxy or a supercluster, 12 billion years. I don't know how far out your eyes actually see light that is coming in without telescope. But he wouldn't have even, really probably would not have grasped the word billion if you had mentioned it to him. And this light is traveling to us at 186,000 miles per second and takes 10 billion years to get to me. And I look at it and I say, what is man? And in fact, the time differential between the time David saw them and I saw them is insignificant. David and I are contemporaries on a universal scale. We live together. We could have walked out on the same night for any discernible difference in the length of time that was involved in when we saw these things. And I realize, as I look at these, and what I have learned is that they tell me all of these things are moving away from me at an ever-increasing rate of speed. And that if you turn time backwards and rotate back, there was a time when all of these things were in one place. Every star, every solar system, every galaxy, every supercluster, all of these things were at one time in one place. Stephen Hawking, with simplicity, calls it a singularity. And he said, it is pointless, it is meaningless to discuss what was before the singularity. For there was no time before. There was no space before, because time and space began with the singularity. What popularly we call the Big Bang. And so God said, let there be light. And in that moment, there was searing, white, heat, light, energy of something that I try to grapple with it, but I know that I'm not coming close or even beginning to understand what it means. But I know that Stephen Hawking is wrong about one thing. That before the singularity, there was time. Because I know that before God ever so much as uttered a word to create this universe, he had planned whatever it is that he intended to do with it before he got through. And to whatever extent that God does one thing before he does another thing, to the extent that A is done before B, there is time. It may not be time as you know it. In fact, I am certain that it is not. But it is time in a sense, that a sequence of events. And so that God went to work at a point in time with an objective in mind, with something he intended to accomplish, with a goal to carry out. And I think it was a lot like James Weldon Johnson said in the poem, The Creation. And God stepped out on space, and he looked around and said, I'm lonely. I'll make me a world. And as far as the eye of God could see, darkness covered everything, blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp. Then God smiled, and the light broke. Just another way of saying, He started it all, but He started it all with a plan, with a purpose, going somewhere and intending to accomplish something with it. And then He came to a place to where He had gotten the heavens and the earth finished. He had put plants and animals on the earth, and He had made an environment fit for what it was that He was going to do. And what it was that He was going to do was to make man. The environment fit for man was finished, and man was placed upon the earth. That great God kneeled down and formed together into the dust of the earth the form and the shape of a man, and He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And God created them, male and female created He them, and He put them in the Garden of Eden and said, blessed them and said, be fruitful and replenish the earth, and here's the garden, and dress it and keep it. But before you dress it and keep it, let's take the day off. Let's take a day off and spend some time together before they ever started. When you get on into the book of Genesis chapter 2, it says that God, first of all, looked out on all that He had made, and He said, oh, it is good. And then it says, He rested the seventh day. Exodus 31 goes beyond and says that He rested and was refreshed. Now, this is a really interesting thought to me. Because I've had people ask me before about Genesis, the second chapter, about God resting. It says, why did God need to rest? Was God tired? And they will cite the scripture that says, oh, God who fainteth not, neither is weary. God who does not grow tired. God doesn't wear out. You know, God doesn't sleep. God goes around the clock. And I know all that. I understand all that. I say I understand it. I really wonder if we understand it, because we have this image of God that we have created. Sometimes it is our own idea. It is our own image and our own thoughts about the way God is and the way God feels and the way God responds and the way He reacts to man. But I would have a hard time, I agree with you, grappling with the idea that God was tired somehow of what He had done. But then there's this expression in Exodus the 31st chapter, I believe it's about verse 17, where He says that He rested and He was refreshed. Now, I write a lot. And I get up in the mornings, and I like to write in the morning. And it seems like overnight, I don't know what happens exactly overnight, but by morning, I am ready to write. I get a cup of coffee, I go to my computer, my word processor, and I sit down and I begin to compose along the lines of whatever it is that I am working on this day. On a really good day, I can probably put in about 4 hours worth of writing. Most days it's 1 to 1.5 to 2, because I have a job I have to go to. Mercifully, they will let me, Mr. Armstrong will let me come in almost any time of the day that I want to. And so consequently, I sometimes work until noon at home before I ever go to the office, because once I go to the office, creative work is finished. It's administrative stuff after that. And I find that when I get to a certain point, I write to a certain point, and there is no point after that in continuing, because nothing will flow. That my mind has got to go through another cycle of either taking in information or processing information or putting the information together in different ways from what that information was put in before, so that I will then be able to use it. And I've also learned something else, that when you go to sleep, your mind does work. You go to sleep, and all of a sudden, when everything starts relaxing, there is something in your, for those of your computer buffs, in your operating system, that begins to go to work sorting your data. You know, you've got stuff like a computer scattered all over your hard drive being your brain. And the thing goes to work, and it starts pulling data out of here and out of this spot and out of this spot and this spot, and then runs down here for a ways and then resorts it back into new places. It does all this stuff, I think, while you're asleep. It's one of the strange things about dreams is, it's almost as though your little operator in there goes running down here and looks inside this cupboard and says, no, that's not the place, and keeps right on running down. But when you open that cupboard up, you all of a sudden, you know, were dreaming about this person chasing you down the street without any clothes on. You were the one without any clothes on, I mean. And so these strange things go on while your mind deals with the information that you have. And in the process of creativity, we don't really create strictly speaking, a lot of new stuff. And what we do is we take things that we know and we combine them in new ways, and we create from these new concepts, new ways of looking at things, new information. It's not new information, it's just a new way of putting the information together. Now, in my experience, I find that there is a need to stop, to rest, and to refresh the creative urge, impulse, ability, and so forth that exists in man. Then I contemplate what God said about this, or told Moses to write down for us to read his testimony. That God created us in His image. In the image of God, male and female created He them. And now you will go into endless arguments about, somebody will have to know, they just have to know this, does God have hands? And does God have feet? Does God have a nose? You know, does He have ears? Does He have a belly button? Which is a kind of an odd question. But people want to ask all these questions about God, and they're interesting. And if you want to know what I think God does have hands and head and feet and all this type of stuff. I really think so. But that's not really relevant. I'll tell you what I think is far more important, and that is that our mind is made in the image of God. That our mind is made so that we may understand Him, that we may grasp Him, and more important, that we may communicate with Him. Our mind is designed so that He can give us information about Himself that we can know, that we can use, that we can deal with, so that when we fall to our knees and we lift up our hands or our face to heaven and we say, "Our Father who art in heaven," that the words we are saying mean something to Him and to us. For it's not enough for them to mean something to us and not mean anything to Him. Nor is it enough for it to mean something to Him and not mean anything to us. I don't want to sit next to somebody I like and is a good friend of mine and have him speaking a language I don't understand. We want to be together to talk, to share, to exchange ideas, to deal with concepts, to sharpen one another, to focus one another, to exchange. And when I read something that says that Abraham was a friend of God, oh, how I would yearn to have that kind of a relationship with God. I have had a few people on this planet that have been such close friends that I had no idea of the passage of time when I was with them and when we were talking and we were sharing things together. When we hadn't seen each other in a long time, that we would stay up until 1 and 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning just talking to one another about whatever in a free flow conversation. Can you imagine what it would be like to have that kind of talk with God? I guess in a way we can. Our conversation may tend to be one-sided, but it doesn't need to be terribly one-sided because you got this. You can talk to Him, but you know, He's been talking for a long time. Maybe He wants to listen for a while. But I really think, man being made in the image of God, that this awareness of God and of His creation and how He brought man is important for me to understand that God came to a place in what He was doing where He wanted to stop and enjoy what He had done. I really believe it is as simple as that. It's not a question of being tired. It's not a question of being worn out. It's not a question of not having the resources to go on. Because the truth is that you and I a lot of times have the physical resources to work 7 days a week for a very long period of time. And we get to Friday night, we're not through. And we may not even be whipped. We may be ready to get up Saturday morning and go right on like nothing had ever happened. You know, we can just carry on. But God said no. He also could have gone on. But He said, "I will not." Why? I want to enjoy what I have made. And then there's this other little word that He said, that God stopped, rested, and was refreshed. Is it possible that out of the experience of stopping, out of the experience of resting, out of the experience of enjoying what one has done, that even God finds, and at this point in time my words and my vocabulary fail me, and there's not a word that I can use at this point that you cannot take exception to. So I will use the one I want to anyway. That God is renewed. That He is renewed. and that he is ready to work again at a higher level, at a greater level, if that's possible with God, that God himself actually is able to grow, to become bigger, to become greater himself. I know the theological problems that creates, but after all, Paul said that men will feel after God if haply they might find him. And I fear much more making up my mind about God than I fear wandering off down a little strange blind alley that I can come back out of and say, no, that wasn't the way it should have been. This is the way I should know and I should understand God. Now, I have said all that to say this. That God, the one who with his smile or with a word created the singularity, the one who created the environment fit for man, the one who finally then created man, and the first thing he tells the man is, let's take the day off together. The God who rested and was refreshed, that's my God. Not some other God, not some other set of characteristics, not some other God who had another day named after him. That God is my God. Now, I told you that I would know this if there were no scripture that told me that, but there is one that does. And I think you probably could beat me to it, but it's Matthew 10. In Matthew, the 10th chapter. And I'll begin reading in verse 24. The disciple is not above his master, nor the servant is above his Lord. It is enough for the disciple that he be like his master, and the servant be like his Lord. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household? There is nothing, therefore, that is covered that shall not be revealed. There is nothing hid that shall not be made known. What I tell you in darkness, I want you to speak in the light. What you hear in the ear, I want you to preach it from the housetops. And don't be afraid of them who can kill the body. And don't be afraid of those who can take away your job. Don't be afraid of those that can take away your livelihood. But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And have all the fun you want with the theology on that. Just be afraid of God. Are not two sparrows sold for more than a farthing, and one of them shall not fall on the ground without your father? The very hairs of your head are numbered. Don't be afraid. He said, you are of more value than many sparrows. Whoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. And he that shall deny me before men, I will deny before my Father which is in heaven. And he goes on with this to say, lost my place, but I will find it. He says, whosoever will deny me before men will I deny before my Father which is in heaven. Later on, he says in verse 38, he that takes not his cross and follows after me is not worthy of me. He that finds his life shall lose it, and he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. In the Sabbath, I confess him. I confess him joyfully. I confess him happily. And I think of all the people out there, there are so many stories and so many exciting stories and testimonials that people can give about the Sabbath and how they can tell you that they took the bull by the horns, they made the decision to obey the Sabbath day, they told their boss they weren't going to work, and he threatened them with firing, but it worked out for them and God blessed them, and then this happened and that happened. They can give us these wonderful testimonials about how things worked. And those people have in their lives made a marvelous confession of God. But then there is another group of people. And they're the group of people for whom that confession has not worked, if I may use that term. They have said they would not work on the Sabbath, and the boss said, you're fired. And it was 3 years before they got another job. They have said, I'm sorry, I won't work on the Sabbath day, and they were laid off. They may have got a chance to work again for a little while, but they were laid off again. They got a job over here, and they lost the Sabbath again. And they lost the job for it again. They may have worked, you know, at 5 jobs in 5 years and kept losing them for the Sabbath. And it happened again and again and again. You know something? This latter group have probably made the greater confession of faith than the former. For these are people who, in the face of loss, in the face of hurt, in the face of discouragement, in the face of depression, whatever else it is that came their way, said, no, no, no. The God who worked 6 days and rested the seventh is my God. I know that the Father of Jesus is my Father. And I know it's going to sound odd for me to put it to you this way, but I am proud of my Father and what He has done. I want Him to be proud of me.